I use a 12-point font, one whose letters are comfortably large. Alas, this is a trade-off, for the larger the letters on the screen, the less material can fit. Change to a 9-point font, and I can see 78% more material, 33% more lines, each with 33% more words. A non-trivial difference when I'm trying to write long sections. But the letters are 33% smaller, making it harder both to read and to correct them. At least my computer allows flexibility in type size. Most do not. By the time we're 60, enough stray material has scattered about in our eyes that visual contrast is diminished, enough to be one of the major reasons that airline pilots are forced to retire at this age. At the age of 60, a person is still in good mental and physical shape, and the accumulated wisdom of the years leads to superior performance in many tasks. But physical strength is lessened, the agility of the body decreased, and the speed of some operations lessened. In a world where the average age is increasing, 60 is still relatively young. Most 60-year-olds have another 20 years to live. Many have 40. We need to design with these people in mind. Think of it as designing with our future selves in mind. There is no simple solution, no one size fits all. But designing for flexibility helps. Flexibility in the size of the images on computer screens, in the sizes, heights, and angles of tables and chairs. Flexibility on our highways, perhaps making sure there are alternative routes with different speed limits. Fixed solutions will invariably fail with some people. Flexible solutions at least offer a chance for those with special needs. Selective attention. The problem of focus. The ability of conscious attention is limited. Focus on one thing and you reduce your attention to others. Psychologists call the phenomenon selective attention. Excessive focus leads to a kind of tunnel vision, where peripheral items are ignored. I watched a consumer show on British television on toasters that caught fire when the bread was too dry. The consumer representatives pointed out that people often inserted their fingers, a fork, or a knife into the toaster to extract the toast. This was very dangerous, even more dangerous in Britain than in the United States, because the voltage is 240 volts, not the 120 of the United States. Yet some toasters had exposed wires very close to the top, quite reachable by the finger or the metal utensil. The consumer representatives argued that manufacturers should not have placed the wires so close to the opening. The manufacturers denied that their toasters were dangerous. Why, they asked, would someone stick their fingers or a knife into a toaster? Certainly the instructions warned them not to. Certainly they must know it is dangerous. To the designer, such an action is so unthinkable that prevention did not enter into the design considerations. Consider the matter from the user's point of view. The person sees a problem, stuck or burning toast, and focuses on the solution, to extract it. The danger does not come to mind. To my own surprise, I did the same thing the very next day. I inserted two crumpets into the toaster. A few minutes later, smoke was pouring out. Quick, I ran over to the toaster, popped up the crumpets as far as they would go, and then quickly, but carefully, inserted a knife blade into the toaster down the side to lift them out. What was I doing? Selective attention. Attend to the immediate problem, forget the rest. Sure, I was being careful, but that is probably what the people who electrocuted themselves also believed. It just didn't seem dangerous, that's all. The same story is repeated over and over again. Underwater divers focus so much on struggling to the surface that they fail to release the lead weights on a special easy-to-release belt that are keeping them underwater. People who are fleeing a fire push hard against a door, harder and harder, failing to recognize that the door opens by pulling. Someone is trapped behind a door, pushing against the left side when it opens from the right. Motorcyclists have their helmets strapped to their bike, not their head. People don't use seat belts or they drive too fast because it is inconvenient to do otherwise and because they don't see the danger. When there is a problem, people are apt to focus on it to the exclusion of other factors. The designer must design for the problem case, making other factors more salient, or easier to get to, or perhaps less necessary. That's what the forcing functions of Chapter 5 were all about. Make the power cutoff switch of the toaster a forcing function, so that a person can't stick something into the toaster without flipping a power cutoff switch, which should be easy to get to and use. Or change the design of the wiring and heating elements so that lethal elements cannot be reached from outside, no matter what flesh or metal gets put into the toaster. A corollary principle is that designers must guard against the problems of focus in their own design. Did their attention to one set of variables cause them to neglect another? Did safety suffer for usability? Usability for aesthetics? Aesthetics for manufacturability? The faucet. A case history of design difficulties. It may be hard to believe that an everyday water faucet could need an instruction manual. I saw one, this time at the meeting of the British Psychological Society in Sheffield, England. The participants stayed in dormitories. Upon checking into one of these, the Ranmore House, a guest was given a pamphlet that gave useful information. Where the churches were, the times of meals, the location of the post office, and how to work the taps, faucets. The taps on the washhand basin are operated by pushing down gently. When it was my turn to speak at the conference, I asked the audience about those taps. How many had trouble using it? Polite, restrained titterings from the audience. How many tried to turn the handle? A large show of hands. How many had to seek help? A few honest folks raised their hands. Afterward, one woman came up to me and said that she had given up and had to walk up and down the halls until she found someone who could explain the taps to her. A simple sink. A simple-looking faucet. But it looks like it should be turned, not pushed. If you want the faucet to be pushed, make it look like it should be pushed. It can be done. The airlines do it right. Pity the poor house porters, always getting calls for help about the faucets. So instructions were put in the orientation sheet. Who would ever think of having to read instructions before using a faucet? At least put them on the faucets where they can't be missed. But when simple things need instructions, it is a certain sign of poor design. Why are faucets so hard to get right? Let us take a closer look at the two major variables. They will give us quite enough to do. The person who uses the faucets cares about two things, the water temperature and volume. Two things to control. We should be able to do that with two controls, one for each. Except that water comes in two pipes, hot and cold. And so the two things that are easiest to control, volume of hot water and volume of cold water, are not the two things we want to have controlled. Hence the designer's dilemma. There are three problems. Two relate to the mapping of intentions to actions, and the third is the problem of evaluation. Which faucet controls the hot, which the cold? What do you do to the faucet to make it increase or decrease the water flow? How do you determine if the volume or temperature is correct? The two mapping problems are solved through cultural conventions, or constraints. It is a worldwide convention that the left faucet should be hot, the right cold. It is also a universal convention that screw heads are made to tighten with clockwise turning, loosen with counterclockwise. You turn off a faucet by tightening a screw thread, tightening a washer against its seat, thereby shutting off the flow of water. So clockwise turning shuts off the water. Counterclockwise turns it on. Unfortunately, the constraints do not always hold. Most of the English people I asked were not aware that left hot, right cold was a convention. It is violated too often to be considered a convention in England. But the convention isn't universal in the United States. Look at the picture of a shower control from my own university. Refer to Figure 24. Here we have vertical faucets. Vertical? If left is the standard for hot, how does that translate to vertical arrangements? Is hot the top or the bottom? Weird. Sometimes a designer messes with the convention on purpose. The human body has a mirror image symmetry, says this pseudo-psychologist, So if the left hand moves clockwise, why the right hand should move counterclockwise. Watch out. Your plumber or architect may install a bathroom fixture where clockwise rotation turns the hot water off and the cold water on. Or is it the other way around? No matter. As you try to control the water temperature, soap running down over your eyes, groping to change the water control with one hand, soap or shampoo clutched in the other, you are guaranteed to get it wrong. The water is freezing, so you try to increase the amount of hot. You will probably turn on the shower, or the bath, or open the drain, or shut it, or turn off the hot water completely, or scald yourself. Whoever invented that mirror image nonsense should be forced to take a shower. Yes, there is some logic to it. To be a bit fair to the inventor of the scheme, it does work reasonably well as long as you always use the faucets by placing both hands on them at the same time, adjusting both controls simultaneously. It fails miserably, however, when one hand is used to alternate between the two controls. Then you cannot remember which direction does what. What about the evaluation problem? Feedback in the use of most faucets is rapid and direct, so turning them the wrong way is easy to discover and correct. The evaluate action cycle is easy to traverse. As a result, the discrepancy from normal rules is often not noticed, unless you are in the shower and the feedback occurs when you scald yourself. Older sinks have two separate spouts. Here, evaluation is difficult. You can wave your hand rapidly back and forth between the spouts, hoping thereby to get a good mix of temperatures, or you can fill up the basin, adjusting the amount of hot and cold water so that the accumulating mixture reaches the desired temperature. Usually you settle for anything in the neighborhood. Each problem alone isn't a big deal, but the total sum of all the trivial maldesign unnecessarily adds to the trauma of everyday life. Now consider the modern single-spout, single-control faucet. Technology to the rescue. Move the control one way, it adjusts temperature. Move it another, it adjusts volume. Hurrah! We control exactly the variables of interest, and the mixing spout solves the evaluation problem. Yes, these new faucets are beautiful, sleek, elegant, prize-winning. Unusable. They solved one set of problems, only to create yet another. The mapping problems now predominate. Which control is associated with which action? What operations do you apply to the controls? The problem is that it is very difficult to figure out which part of the sleek faucet is the control. And even if you figure that out, it is hard to figure out in which direction it moves. And once you figure that out, it is hard to figure out which direction controls which action. And when these fancy, multi-purpose, sleek designs also control the basin plug and the diversion of water to shower or bath, disaster awaits. There are two problems here. First, in the name of elegance, the moving parts sometimes meld invisibly into the faucet structure, making it nearly impossible even to find the controls, let alone figure out which way they move or what they control. Second, in the name of novelty, the new designs have forfeited the power of cultural constancy. Users don't want each new design to use a different method for controlling the water. Users need standardization. If all makers of faucets could agree on a standard set of motions to control amount and temperature, how about up and down to control amount, up meaning increase, and left and right to control temperature, left meaning hot? Then we could all learn the standards once and forever afterward use the knowledge for every new faucet we encountered. If you can't put the knowledge on the device, then develop a cultural constraint. Standardize what has to be kept in the head. There could be small variations in the standard. Suppose a designer wanted temperature to be controlled by a knob that turned rather than by a lever that moved left and right. Fortunately, there is a natural mapping that relates turning to direction. A clockwise turning is the same as moving to the right, getting colder, and a counterclockwise turning is the same as moving to the left, hotter. Technological development never ceases. There is yet another solution to the control problem, one that has a slight virtue over the others. It is cheaper. One control turns the water on or off and lets you adjust either temperature or volume, but not both. All you have to do is locate the control and operate it. Think of all the mental energy and confusion you have been saved. We finally have a control that is truly easy to use. Success! Wait. We really do want to control both amount and temperature independently. This solution gives us only one control. So we can adjust temperature, but we get out whatever amount of water the designer thought was good for us. Or we can adjust the amount while getting an arbitrary temperature. The story of progress. Some variants on this faucet control only on or off. You have control over neither volume nor temperature. Sometimes there is no visible means to turn on the water. How does the novice user realize that one is supposed to wave the hands under the faucet? There is no sign of the required operation, no relevant information in the world. Perhaps you have a big sign. Do not adjust controls. Simply place hand under spout. The sign ruins the elegance, doesn't it? Interesting choice. Understandability or elegance? Of course, if such faucets became common, then people would know how to use them, and the signs could come down. Someday. Two deadly temptations for the designer. Let's return to the designer's problems. I've mentioned the time and economic pressures on them. Now let me tell you of two deadly temptations that await the unwary. Temptations that lead toward products that are overly complex. Products that drive users to distraction. I call these creeping featureism and the worshipping of false images. Creeping featureism. I recently attended a demonstration of a new word processing program held in a large, crowded auditorium. A representative from the company sat in front of the computer, a video projector putting a large image of the computer screen onto the movie screen. The audience was skeptical. They were experts and knew the limitations of such programs. The demonstrator was smooth and convincing, composing an outline, expanding it into text, indenting the paragraphs, numbering them, changing their styles, flipping into a drawing program, drawing a figure, inserting the drawing into the text with the text flowing neatly around the drawing. "You want two columns?" asked the demonstrator. "Here it is." "Three columns? Four? Just name it." The screen flowed, three columns of text neatly lined up, illustrations just where they ought to be, page headers, footers, paragraph numbers, boldface italics. Large type, small type, footnotes neatly displayed at the end of columns. You could even highlight just the things that had been changed in the last revision. You could leave notes for yourself, or a co-author, notes that would appear on the screen, but need not be printed in the final text. The audience applauded. They called out for their favorite features. Usually the demonstrator would say, "Yes, I am glad you asked. Here it is," and whiz, bang, wave of hands, click of keys, swish of the mouse, and the screen would display the latest called-for feature. Sometimes the demonstrator would say, "Not yet. It will be in the second release, in a few months." Creeping featureism is the tendency to add to the number of features that a device can do, often extending the number beyond all reason. There is no way that a program can remain usable and understandable by the time it has all of those special purpose features. The word processor I use on my home computer comes with a 340-page reference manual, plus a 150-page introductory manual intended for first-time users, who probably can't understand the reference manual until they have first read the learning manual. Emacs, the text editor I use on my university computer, comes with a 250-page manual, which would be longer if you weren't assumed to be expert at many things. How can users cope? How can users protect themselves from themselves? After all, as the story of the demonstration illustrates, it is the users who request the features. The designers are simply obliging them. But each new set of features adds immeasurably to the size and complexity of the system. More and more things have to be made invisible, in violation of all the principles of design. No constraints, no affordances, invisible, arbitrary mappings. And all because the users have demanded features. Creeping featureism is a disease, fatal if not treated promptly. There are some cures, but as usual, the best approach is to practice preventive medicine. The problem is that the disease comes so naturally, so innocently. Analyze a task and you see how it can be made easier. Why, adding features seems so virtuous, following the very preachings of this book, simply trying to make life easier for everyone. But with extra features comes extra complexity. Each new feature adds yet another control, or display, or button, or instruction. Complexity probably increases as the square of the features. Double the number of features, quadruple the complexity. Provide 10 times as many features, multiply the complexity by 100. There are 2 paths to treating featureism. One is avoidance, or at the least, great restraint. Yes, allow features that seem absolutely necessary, but steel yourself to the rigors of doing without the rest. Once a device has multiple functions, there is no way to avoid having multiple controls and operations, multiple pages of instructions, multiple difficulties and confusions. The second path is organization. Organize, modularize, use the strategy of divide and conquer. Suppose we take each set of features and hide them away in separate locations, perhaps with dividing barriers between sets. The technical word is modularization. Create separate functional modules, each with a limited set of controls, each specialized for some different aspect of the task. The virtue is that each separate module has limited properties, limited features, yet the sum total of features in the device is unchanged. The proper division of a complex set of controls into modules allows you to conquer complexity. The worshipping of false images. The designer and user may further be tempted to worship complexity. Some of my students did a study of office copying machines. They discovered that the most expensive, most feature-laden machines were best sellers among law firms. Did the firms need the extra features of the machines? No. It turns out that they liked to put them in the front offices where clients were waiting. Impressive machines, with flashing lights and pretty displays. The firm gained an aura of being modern and up-to-date, capable of dealing with the rigors of modern high technology. The fact that the machines were too complex to be mastered by most of the people in the firms was irrelevant. The copiers did not even have to be used. Appearance alone did the job. Ah, yes, the worshipping of false images, in this case by the customers. A colleague told me of her difficulties with her home audio television set. It was comprised of separate components, each alone not too complex. But the combination was so overwhelming that she could not use it. Her solution was to work through each of the operations she wished to perform and write explicit instructions for herself. And even with these instructions, operation was not easy. Here, the culprit clearly is the interactions among components. Imagine having to write several pages of instructions in order to use your own audio set. In the case of the overly complex audio television set, the components were from different manufacturers. Nonetheless, they were intended to be purchased and used individually. I have seen equal complexity in components from a single manufacturer. Some salespeople try to create the impression that this is how it has to be, that anyone with any technical competence can manage to work the devices. No, that attitude won't work. The equipment is simply too complex, the interaction between components too overwhelming. There was nothing particularly elaborate about my colleague's equipment. This person was reasonably sophisticated in technical things. She has a PhD in computer science, but was baffled by an everyday audio set. One of the problems with audio-video equipment is that even if each component has been designed with care, The interaction between components causes problems. The tuner, cassette deck, television, VCR, CD player, and so on, all seem to be designed in relative isolation. Put them all together, and there is chaos. An amazing proliferation of controls, lights, meters, and interconnections that can defeat even the most talented. In this case, the false image is appearance of technical sophistication. This is the sin responsible for the extra complexity of many of our devices, from telephones and televisions to dishwashers and washing machines, from automobile dashboards to audio-visual sets. There is no remedy except through education. You might argue that this is a victimless sin, hurting only those who practice it, but this is not true. Manufacturers and designers produce products for what they perceive as their market demands. Therefore, if enough people sin in this way, and the evidence is that they do, then the rest of us must pay for the pleasures of a few. We pay in fancy, colorful-looking equipment that is nearly impossible to use. The foibles of computer systems. Now turn to the computer, an area where all the major difficulties of design can be found in profusion. In this realm, the user is seldom considered. There is nothing particularly special about the computer. It is a machine, a human artifact, just like the other sorts of things we have looked at, and it poses few problems that we haven't encountered already. But designers of computer systems seem particularly oblivious to the needs of users, particularly susceptible to all the pitfalls of design. The professional design community is seldom called in to help with computer products. Instead, design is left in the hands of engineers and programmers, people who usually have no experience and no expertise in designing for people. The abstract nature of the computer poses a particular challenge for the designer. The computer works electronically, invisibly, with no sign of the actions it is performing, and it is instructed through an abstract language, one that specifies the internal flow of control and movement of information, but one that is not particularly suited for the needs of the user. Specialized programmers work in these languages to instruct the system to perform its operations. The task is complex, and programmers must have a variety of skills and talents. The design of a program requires a combination of expertise, including technical skills, knowledge of the task, and knowledge of the needs and abilities of the users. Programmers should not be responsible for the computer's interaction with the user. That is not their expertise, nor should it be. Many existing programs for user applications are too abstract, requiring actions that make sense for the demands of the computer and to the computer professional, but that are not cohesive, sensible, necessary, or understandable to the everyday user. To make the system easier to use and to understand requires a large amount of extra work. I sympathize with the problems of the programmer, but I cannot excuse the general lack of concern for the users. How to do things wrong. Ever sit down to a typical computer? If so, you have encountered the tyranny of the blank screen. The person sits in front of the computer screen ready to begin. Begin what? How? The screen is either completely blank or contains non-informative symbols or words that give no hint of what is expected. There is a typewriter-like keyboard, but there is no reason to suppose that one key is preferable to any other. Anyway, isn't it true that one wrong keystroke can blow up the machine, or destroy valuable data, or accidentally get connected to some top-secret data bank and then be investigated by the Secret Service? Who knows what danger lurks in the key press? It is almost as frightening as being taken to a party filled with strange people, being led to the center of the room and let go. Your host disappears, saying, "Make yourself at home. I'm sure there are lots of people you can talk to." Not me. I retreat to the fringes and try to find something to read. What is the problem? Nothing special, just more of everything. The special powers of the computer can amplify all the usual problems to new levels of difficulty. If you set out to make something difficult to use, You could probably do no better than to copy the designers of modern computer systems. Do you want to do things wrong? Here is what to do. Make things invisible. Widen the gulf of execution. Give no hints to the operations expected. Establish a gulf of evaluation. Give no feedback, no visible results of the actions just taken. Exploit the tyranny of the blank screen. Be arbitrary. Computers make this easy. Use non-obvious command names or actions. Use arbitrary mappings between the intended action and what must actually be done. Be inconsistent. Change the rules. Let something be done one way in one mode and another way in another mode. This is especially effective where it is necessary to go back and forth between the two modes. Make operations unintelligible. Use idiosyncratic language or abbreviations. Use uninformative error messages. Be impolite. Treat erroneous actions by the user as breaches of contract. Snarl. Insult. Mumble unintelligible verbiage. Make operations dangerous. Allow a single erroneous action to destroy invaluable work. Make it easy to do disastrous things. But put warnings in the manual. Then, when people complain, you can ask, "But didn't you read the manual?" This list is getting depressing, so let us turn to the good side. The computer has vast potential, more than enough to overcome all its problems. Because it has unlimited power, because it can accept almost any kind of control, and because it can create almost any kind of picture or sound, it has the potential to bridge the gulfs, to make life easier. If designed properly, systems can be tailored for and by each of us. But we must insist that the computer developers work for us, not for the technology, not for themselves. Programs and systems do exist that have shown us the potential. They take the user into account, and they make it easier for us to do our tasks. Pleasurable, even. This is how it ought to be. Computers have the power not only to make everyday tasks easier, but to make them enjoyable as well. It's not too late to do things right. Computer technology is still young, still exploring its potential. The notion lingers that if you have not passed the secret rites of initiation into programming skills, you should not be allowed into the society of computer users. It is like the early days of the automobile. Only the brave, the adventurous, and the mechanically sophisticated need apply. Computer scientists have so far worked on developing powerful programming languages that make it possible to solve the technical problems of computation. Little effort has gone toward devising the languages of interaction. Every student programmer takes courses on the computational aspect of computers. But there are very few courses on the problems faced by the user. Such courses are usually not required, and they are not easy to fit into the already crowded schedule of the fledgling computer scientist. As a result, most programmers fluently write computer programs that do wonderful things, but that are unusable by the non-professional. Most programmers have never thought of the problems faced by the users. They are surprised to discover that their creations tyrannize the user. There is no longer any excuse for this. It is not that difficult to develop programs that make visible their actions, that allow the user to see what is going on, that make the set of possible actions visible, that display the current state of the system in a meaningful and clear way. Let me give you some examples of excellent work, systems that do take into account the needs of the user. First, there is the spreadsheet, an accounting program that has changed the face of office bookkeeping. The first spreadsheet program, VisiCalc, was so impressive that people bought computers just so they could use this one program. That is a strong argument for its usability. Spreadsheets have their problems, but on the whole, they allow people to work with numbers in a convenient way, with immediately visible results. What did people like about the spreadsheet? The way it looked. You didn't seem to be using a computer. You were working on your problem. You organized the problem just the way you always would, except now it was easy to make changes. easy to see the results. Change one number, and everything that depended on that number changed along with it, in just the proper way. What a painless way to do budget projections. All the benefits of the computer without the technical impediments. In fact, the best computer programs are the ones in which the computer itself disappears, in which you work directly on the problem without having to be aware of the computer. Actually, VisiCalc had numerous problems. The concept was brilliant, but the execution was flawed. I'm not complaining about the designers, for they were limited by the power of an earlier generation of personal computers. Today's personal computers are much more powerful, and the spreadsheet programs are much easier to use. But the program established the model. It felt as if you were working directly on the problem, not on a computer. It is not easy to develop effective and usable computer systems. For one thing, it is expensive. Consider the principles described in this book. Visibility, constraints, affordances, natural mappings, feedback. Applied to computer systems, these mean that, among other things, the computer must be capable of making things visible or audible, which requires large and high-quality visual displays, a variety of input devices, and plenty of computer memory. These require faster, more powerful computer circuits, and all this adds up to more expensive systems, more cost to manufacture, more cost to the consumer. It may not be immediately clear that the everyday users of computer systems are the ones who require the most powerful systems, with the most memory and the best display. Professional programmers can get by with less, for they know how to deal with more complex interactions and less effective displays. The first proper attempt to build an effective system was not a commercial success. This was the Xerox Star, a brainchild of the Xerox Corporation's Palo Alto Research Center. The developers recognized the importance of large, highly detailed display screens with plenty of graphics. They gave the machine the ability to have several different documents on the screen at the same time. And they introduced a pointing device, in this case, the mouse, for the user to specify a work area on the screen. The Xerox Star computer was a breakthrough in usable design, but the system was too expensive and too slow. Users liked the power and the ease of operation, but they needed better performance. The benefits of easy-to-use commands were completely outweighed by the slow response speed. The display could not always keep up with typing, and requests for explanation, the help system, sometimes took so long that a user could go for a cup of coffee while waiting for an answer to even the simplest question. Xerox showed the way, but suffered a common fate of pioneers. The spirit was willing, but the implementation weak. Fortunately for the consumer, the Apple Computer Company has followed through on Xerox's ideas, using the philosophy developed for the Xerox Star, and hiring away some of Xerox's people, to produce first the Apple Lisa, also too slow and expensive and a failure in the marketplace, and then the Macintosh, a success story. The approach followed by Xerox has been well documented. The major goal was consistency of operations, to make things visible so that the available options could always be determined, and to test each idea with users at every step of the development process. These are all the important characteristics of good system design. Apple's Macintosh computer makes extensive use of visual displays. These eliminate the blank screen. The user can see what alternative actions are possible. The computer also makes the actions relatively easy to do, and it standardizes procedures so that methods learned for one program apply to most other programs. There is good feedback. Many actions are done by moving a mouse, a small handheld pointing device that causes a marker to move to the appropriate location on the screen. The mouse provides good mapping of action to result, and the use of menus, choices spelled out on the screen, makes the operations easy to perform. The gulf of execution and the gulf of evaluation are both securely bridged. The Macintosh fails badly at many things, especially those for which it uses obscure combinations of key presses to accomplish some task. Many of the problems arise from the use of the mouse. The mouse has one button, which simplifies its use, but means that some actions must be specified by clicking the button several times, or by simultaneously holding down various combinations of keys on the keyboard and clicking the mouse button. These actions violate the basic design philosophy. They are difficult to learn, difficult to remember, and difficult to do. Ah, the buttons on the mouse problem. How many buttons should the mouse have? Various models use 1, 2, or 3, 3 being the most common number. Actually, some mice have more buttons. One design even has a cord keyboard on it. Fierce arguments rage over the correct number. The answer, of course, is that there is no correct answer. It is a trade-off. Increase the number of buttons and you simplify some operations, but you also increase the complexity of the mapping problem. Even 2 buttons lead to an inconsistent mapping of functions to buttons. Reduce to 1 button and the mapping problem goes away, but so too does some of the functionality. The Macintosh provides an example of what computer systems could be like. The design emphasizes visibility and feedback. Its human interface guidelines and its internal toolbox provide standards for the many programmers who design for it. It has emphasized consideration for the user. Yes, there are several serious drawbacks to the Macintosh. It is far from perfect, and it isn't unique. Still, for its relative success in making usability and understanding into primary design objectives, I'd give the Apple Macintosh a prize. If only I thought more of prizes. Computer as chameleon. The computer is unusual among machines in that its shape, form, and appearance are not fixed. They can be anything the designer wishes them to be. The computer can be like a chameleon, changing shape and outward appearance to match the situation. The operations of the computer can be soft, being done in appearance rather than substance, and the appearance can be reversed with a change of mind by the user. As users, we can create explorable systems that can be learned through experimentation, without fear of failure or damage. Furthermore, the computer can take on the appearance of the task. It can disappear behind a facade, its system image. Explorable systems, inviting experimentation. One important method of making systems easier to learn and to use is to make them explorable, to encourage the user to experiment and learn the possibilities through active exploration. This is how many people learn about home appliances, or about a new stereo system, television set, or video game. Work the buttons while listening and looking to see what happens. The same can be true with computer systems. There are 3 requirements for a system to be explorable. 1. In each state of the system, the user must readily see and be able to do the allowable actions. The visibility acts as a suggestion, reminding the user of possibilities and inviting the exploration of new ideas and methods. 2. The effect of each action must be both visible and easy to interpret. This property allows users to learn the effects of each action, to develop a good mental model of the system, and to learn the causal relationships between actions and outcomes. The system image plays a critical role in making such learning possible. 3. Actions should be without cost. When an action has an undesirable result, it must be readily reversible. This is especially important with computer systems. In the case of an irreversible action, the system should make clear what effect the contemplated action will have prior to its execution. There should be enough time to cancel the plan. Or the action should be difficult to do, non-explorable. Most actions should be cost-free, explorable, discoverable. 2 modes of computer usage. Compare 2 different ways of getting a task done. One way is to issue commands to someone else who does the actual work. Call this command mode, or third-person interaction. The other way is to do the operations yourself. Call this direct manipulation mode, or first-person interaction. The difference between these 2 is like the difference between being driven by a chauffeur and driving an automobile yourself. These two different modes exist with computers. Most computer systems offer command mode, third-person interactions. To use the computer, you type commands to it, using a special command language that you have to learn. Some computer systems offer direct manipulation, first-person interactions. Good examples being the driving, flying, and sports games that are commonplace in arcades and on home machines. In these games, the feeling of direct control over the actions is an essential part of the task. This feeling of directness is also possible with everyday computer tasks, such as writing or bookkeeping. Spreadsheet programs and many text editors and word processing programs are good examples of direct manipulation systems used in business. Both forms of interaction are needed. Third-person interaction is well-suited for situations in which the job is laborious or repetitive, as well as those in which you can trust the system or other person to do the job for you properly. Sometimes it is nice to have a chauffeur. But if the job is critical, novel, or ill-specified, or if you do not yet know exactly what is to be done, then you need direct first-person interaction. Now direct control is essential. An intermediary gets in the way. But direct manipulation first-person systems have their drawbacks. Although they are often easy to use, fun, and entertaining, it is often difficult to do a really good job with them. They require the user to do the task directly, and the user may not be very good at it. Colored pencils and musical instruments are good examples of direct manipulation systems. But I, for one, am not a good artist or musician. When I want good art or good music, I need professional assistance. So too with many direct manipulation computer systems. I find that I often need first-person systems for which there is a backup intermediary, ready to take over when asked, available for advice when needed. When I use a direct manipulation system, whether for text editing, drawing pictures, or creating and playing games, I do think of myself not as using a computer, but as doing the particular task. The computer is, in effect, invisible. The point cannot be overstressed. Make the computer system invisible. This principle can be applied with any form of system interaction, direct or indirect. The invisible computer of the future. Consider what the computer of the future might look like. Suppose I told you it wouldn't even be visible, that you wouldn't even know you were using one. What do I mean? Well, this is already true. You use computers when you use many modern automobiles, microwave ovens and games, or CD players and calculators. You don't notice the computer because you think of yourself as doing the task, not as using the computer. In the same sense, you don't go to the kitchen to use an electric motor. You go to use the refrigerator, or the blender, or the dishwasher. The motors are part of the task, even in the case of the blender, mixer, or food processor, which are essentially pure motors and the specialized attachments they drive. The computer of the future is perhaps best illustrated by my imaginary perfect calendar. Suppose I am home one evening, deciding whether to accept an invitation to attend a conference next May. I pick up my appointment calendar and turn to the appropriate page. I tentatively decide that I can attend and pencil in the topic. The calendar flashes at me and displays a note reminding me that the university will still be in session during that period, and that the trip overlaps my wife's birthday. I decide that the conference is important, so I make a note to check whether I can get someone to take over my classes, and to see whether I can leave the conference early for the birthday. I close the calendar and get back to other things. The next day, when I arrive at my office, I find two notes on my message screen. One to find a substitute for my classes next May, the other to check with the conference organizers to see if I can leave early. This imaginary calendar looks like a calendar. It's about the size of a standard pad of paper. It opens up to display dates. But it really is a computer, so it can do things that today's appointment calendar cannot. It can, for example, present its information in different formats. It can display the pages compressed so that a whole year fits on one page. It can expand the display so that I see a single day in 30-minute intervals. Because I frequently use my calendar in conjunction with my travels, the calendar is also an address book, notepad, and expense account record. Most important, it can also connect itself to my other systems via a wireless infrared or electromagnetic channel. Thus, whatever I enter into the calendar gets transmitted to my office and home systems so that they are always in synchrony. If I make an appointment or change someone's address or telephone number on one system, the others get told. When I finish a trip, the expense record can be transferred to the expense account form. The computer is invisible, hidden beneath the surface. Only the task is visible. Although I may actually be using a computer, I feel as if I am using my appointment calendar. Chapter 7. User-Centered Design. The point of POET is to advocate a user-centered design, a philosophy based on the needs and interests of the user, with an emphasis on making products usable and understandable. In this chapter, I summarize the main principles, discuss some implications, and offer suggestions for the design of everyday things. Design should make it easy to determine what actions are possible at any moment. Make use of constraints. Make things visible, including the conceptual model of the system, the alternative actions, and the results of actions. Make it easy to evaluate the current state of the system. Follow natural mappings between intentions and the required actions, between actions and the resulting effect, and between the information that is visible and the interpretation of the system state. In other words, make sure that 1. The user can figure out what to do, and 2. The user can tell what is going on. Design should make use of the natural properties of people and of the world. It should exploit natural relationships and natural constraints. As much as possible, it should operate without instructions or labels. Any necessary instruction or training should be needed only once. With each explanation, the person should be able to say, "Of course," or, "Yes, I see." A simple explanation will suffice if there is reason to the design, if everything has its place and its function, and if the outcomes of actions are visible. If the explanation leads the person to think or say, "How am I going to remember that?" the design has failed. 7 principles for transforming difficult tasks into simple ones. How does the designer go about the task? As I've argued in POET, the principles of design are straightforward. 1. Use both knowledge in the world and knowledge in the head. 2. Simplify the structure of tasks. 3. Make things visible. Bridge the gulfs of execution and evaluation. 4. Get the mappings right. 5. Exploit the power of constraints, both natural and artificial. 6. Design for error. 7. When all else fails, standardize. Use both knowledge in the world and knowledge in the head. I have argued that people learn better and feel more comfortable when the knowledge required for a task is available externally, either explicit in the world or readily derived through constraints. But knowledge in the world is useful only if there is a natural, easily interpreted relationship between that knowledge and the information it is intended to convey about possible actions and outcomes. Note, however, that when a user is able to internalize the required knowledge, that is, to get it into the head, performance can be faster and more efficient. Therefore, the design should not impede action, especially for those well-practiced, experienced users who have internalized the knowledge. It should be easy to go back and forth, to combine the knowledge in the head with that in the world. Let whichever is more readily available at the moment be used without interfering with the other, and allow for mutual support. 3. Conceptual models. The operation of any device, whether it be a can opener, a power-generating plant, or a computer system, is learned more readily, and the problems are tracked down more accurately and easily, if the user has a good conceptual model. This requires that the principles of operation be observable, that all actions be consistent with the conceptual model, and that the visible parts of the device reflect the current state of the device in a way consistent with that model. The designer must develop a conceptual model that is appropriate for the user, that captures the important parts of the operation of the device, and that is understandable by the user. Three different aspects of mental models must be distinguished: the design model, the user's model, and the system image. The design model is the conceptualization that the designer has in mind. The user's model is what the user develops to explain the operation of the system. Ideally, the user's model and the design model are equivalent. However, the user and designer communicate only through the system itself, its physical appearance, its operation, the way it responds, and the manuals and instructions that accompany it. Thus, the system image is critical. The designer must ensure that everything about the product is consistent with and exemplifies the operation of the proper conceptual model. All three aspects are important. The user's model is essential, of course, for that determines what is understood. In turn, it is up to the designer to start with a design model that is functional, learnable, and usable. The designer must ensure that the system reveals the appropriate system image. Only then can the user acquire the proper user's model and find support for the translation of intentions into actions and system state into interpretations. Remember, the user acquires all knowledge of the system from that system image. The role of manuals. The system image includes instruction manuals and documentation. Manuals tend to be less helpful than they should be. They are often written hastily after the product is designed, under severe time pressures and with insufficient resources, and by people who are overworked and underappreciated. In the best of worlds, the manuals would be written first, then the design would follow the manual. While the product was being designed, potential users could simultaneously test the manuals and mock-ups of the system, giving important design feedback about both. Alas, even the best manuals cannot be counted on. Many users do not read them. Obviously, it is wrong to expect to operate complex devices without instruction of some sort, but the designers of complex devices have to deal with human nature as it is. Simplify the structure of tasks. Tasks should be simple in structure, minimizing the amount of planning or problem-solving they require. Unnecessarily complex tasks can be restructured, usually by using technological innovations. Here is where the designer must pay attention to the psychology of the person, to the limits on how much a person can hold in memory at one time, to the limits on how many active thoughts can be pursued at once. These are the limitations of short-term and long-term memory, and of attention. The limitations of short-term memory, STM, are such that a person should not be required to remember more than about 5 unrelated items at one time. If necessary, the system should provide technological assistance for any temporary memory requirements. The limitations of long-term memory, LTM, mean that information is better and more easily acquired if it makes sense, if it can be integrated into some conceptual framework. Moreover, retrieval from LTM is apt to be slow and to contain errors. Here is where information in the world is important, to remind us of what can be done and how to do it. Limitations on attention are also severe. The system should help by minimizing interruption, by providing aids to allow for recovery of the exact status of the operations that were interrupted. A major role of new technology should be to make tasks simpler. A task can be restructured through technology, or technology might provide aids to reduce the mental load. Technological aids can show the alternative courses of action, help evaluate implications, and portray outcomes in a more complete, more easily interpretable manner. These aids can make the mappings more visible, or better, make the mappings more natural. 4 major technological approaches can be followed. Keep the task much the same, but provide mental aids. Use technology to make visible what would otherwise be invisible, thus improving feedback and the ability to keep control. Automate, but keep